This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lepeska, and with me today is Ava Homa, a Kurdish-Iranian journalist and writer whose debut novel, Daughters of Smoke and Fire, was published in May. Hi, Ava, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, David. Thanks so much for having me.
You are welcome. We are speaking on Tuesday, August 4th, the day after I finished reading your novel. And I must say, it's really something. It took you 10 years to write, and I could feel that. It's dense. It's dark and heartbreaking. It's powerful and hopeful. It's about a girl coming of age in a deeply conservative and misogynistic society. It's about living under a heartless, authoritarian, even totalitarian regime. It's about the power of the sibling bond. But most of all, it's about the plight of the Kurds. This is a people that, as your novel points out, were living in this chunk of territory, this Kurdistan, which is now part of Syria, Turkey, Iran, and Iraq, for about 300 years before anybody else came along. They were promised their own state by Western powers after World War I, then denied it a few years later when the Treaty of Lausanne set the borders of Turkey and set the Kurdish people on the path to resistance, rebellion, conflict, and unfathomable suffering, which has today won them a measure of autonomy in Iraq and Syria, but not in Turkey and Iran. Your novel, which The Independent described as blisteringly powerful and named one of the best books of May, and former U.S. Ambassador Peter Galbraith called one of the best books to come out of the Near East in a long time, it tells the story of Leyla Saman, growing up in Marivan, a mainly Kurdish city of some 90,000 people, about 10 miles from the Iraqi border in Iran. The novel opens on the day Leyla's brother Chia is born, which happens to be March 16, 1988, the day Saddam Hussein launched a devastating chemical attack on Halabja, Iraq, killing thousands of people and injuring thousands more with nerve agents and mustard gas in the waning days of the Iran-Iraq War. Halabja is the hometown of Leyla's father, Alan, and we see him devastated and heartbroken on the day his only son is born. So right away, the reader gets the sense that a few moments of joy in this world are likely to pass by unsullied by darkness. This idea that, like, however lovely today might be, disaster looms. Ava, is that something what you were aiming for with this opening juxtaposition?
David, you said it so articulately. Yes, exactly. It's about a group's struggle to find joy in life regardless, and how that is repeatedly denied because of geopolitics.
Leyla's grandfather watches Iraqi authorities wipe out his family, as detailed in the book. Leyla's father sees friends and relatives hung in prison. Then Leyla herself deals with a close relative killed in prison that I won't reveal here. One generation after another lives with death, as close as can be. You left Iran at age 24, and you have written that growing up as a Kurdish girl in Iran, you learned at a young age that being alive was an act of subversion. I wonder if you could expand on that a bit and how it's kind of examined in the book. How did it feel to come of age knowing that your life meant next to nothing to the state, to the police, to the very people whose responsibility it was to protect you?
So, David, there is no real and simple, straightforward answer to your deep question. It's a question that you deal with from the moment you learn your name. And you know that you belong to this group that have been targeted for annihilation. And that's a question that stays with you, I suppose, for the rest of your life, because you're wondering why, how can I make meaning out of it? How can I then be in this world? Why am I so hated? How can I be strong? And then one side of the story is that you're told that, hey, the fact that you're even alive, that you're breathing, that you get to say, hello, I'm Kurdish, that in itself is a victory. But is it really, when you're denied the most basic things that so many people, we don't live in a, you know, beautiful, just world, but most people around you have all the things that then you are denied. So it creates a lot of questions. It creates a vacuum within you that you take generations really to fill out, mostly in vain, but also it gives you a sense of victory that, oh, you know, I'm still here, I'm alive, I'm breathing, I'm going to claim my identity. Even though that's not always the answer, as you know, the tendency to assimilate and to pretend that these things don't exist is also a common way of dealing with all the pain. But what the book does in itself is examining different ways that a group of people, mainly in one family, four members of the family, react to this reality in four different ways, you know? We have the father who is constantly following the news, but he doesn't have the metabolism and the ability to make any sense, anything out of it. So it keeps killing him inside constantly, even though he's alive. We have the mom who would rather not hear about anything, not think about any of those things and go on her own, you know, adventures, sexual adventures. We have Chia, who is in this, the brother, head in and wants to, you know, he thinks there must be a way to bring this perpetrator to international criminal court one day, if only he studies hard, if only he's smart enough to get into one of these competitive universities. And here's Layla, who wishes that she could, you know, detach her life from politics and just follow arts. And while these four individuals think that they have decided a different path, their path constantly intertwines. And one individual's decision inevitably impacts everyone else in the family. So to answer your question, this is something that I guess like at each stage in your life, you try to find a different way to answer it. And maybe there's really no answer to it, you know?
I thought it was interesting. I saw in a recent interview, you said that the coronavirus pandemic has given the rest of the world a taste of the insecurity of being a Kurd in Kurdistan.
Yeah, I was hoping that now that people, you know, rush to this, you know, civilized people who have lived in safety their whole life, you know, you see them rushing to, you know, Walmart and grabbing toilet papers and fighting over rice and things like that. And for a moment you say, yes, exactly. We're all human. This is what happens when we are afraid for our lives, afraid for our safety, afraid for whether or not there's going to be, you know, enough food to feed your family and all of that. I also like when the corona first came, I thought more about, because to me, borders have never made sense. I don't have a country. And that is so different because everyone else that I know has a country and relates to it and has, you know, passions for it. And so this idea of what does it mean to float in this world without having a country has always been a challenge and a question in my head. But now Corona doesn't respect borders at all. Like it doesn't matter how you determine and define your border. It gets through all of those things. So there was, or maybe there still is, a sense of awakening because of the current state that other people are in. There was another moment when I first moved to Canada, I realized that no one discusses politics. And I was a student at the time, I was writing stories. And in my stories, people talk about politics because guess what? In the Kurdish region, everyone constantly talks about politics. And no one in Canada did until they voted for their crazy mayor, Rob Ford. And now everyone was discussing politics. And I was like, okay, this is what happened. So it's not like we are different humans. It's just based on the condition, the topic changes of what you think about, what you discuss, what you bring up, right?
Speaking of awakening, yours is one of the first novels in English written by a Kurdish woman. In a May article for LitHub, you say that when you started your quest to become a writer or started writing, you found that no one had written Kurdish women into literature and that, quote, we had to do it ourselves. And this you have done. In the novel's prologue, you describe the streets as the world of men, judgmental men and hypocritical men. Their honor depends on women men, you write.
Yes.
And as the book opens, five-year-old Layla, 5 years old, recalls her father explaining to her that women are worth half as much as men under Iranian law. This he tells her this in reference to Joanna, the wife of the prison cellmate of Layla's father. She comes to live with the Samans, with Layla's family, with her daughter, Shiler, after her own release from prison. She had been sentenced to death for killing her rapist in self-defense, yet somehow was able to escape this sentence and gain her release. For Layla's mother, Hannah, this is reason enough to question the morality of Joanna, who is already becoming something of a mentor to Layla at age 5. After she brings Chia home from the hospital, Layla's mother kicks Joanna out of their house because she sees her as a gaba, a whore. This coldness toward other women is something of a recurring theme with Hannah, with Layla's mother. After a desperate teenage Layla throws herself in front of a speeding car, her mother's main concern when she visits her in the hospital is not her daughter's physical and mental well-being, both of which are at the time seriously compromised, but whether her virginity is intact. Please, if you would, tell us a bit about the type of woman you sought to highlight with the character of Layla's mother. She's part of this previous generation of women who I guess, raised you and your generation. What were those women like, and how difficult did their worldview make it for their daughters to find a strong sense of self?
Right. So this is a really complicated issue of when women become agents of patriarchy while saying that they're protecting you and they love you and they just want you to be able to make your way in the world. So all of that, all of those comes from women's inability, even when they know, or some women's inability, even when they know what is from a humanitarian perspective, from a humanist perspective, what is good for their daughter versus what's real and what's acceptable, and how can I, you know, make my daughter capable of living in this world. It was also the story of Layla's mom was inspired by, I do a lot of suicide prevention workshop and training on the site in Kurdistan, and you know, from long distance. And a lot of time, these girls who end up choosing death as the final solution are women who are pushed to the edges by their own family, by their mothers. And while that makes me really devastated, it makes me think about what makes a human become the worst enemy of their own children. And this goes to talk about how the oppression that is really on an international level, then it's on the state level, then it's on the family level, how these all pile up to completely destroy women, whether or not they physically stay alive, right? And even when women find the strength and the awareness and the consciousness to now fight for what's right, they're a lot of Kurdish women find themselves in this really tricky position when they are fighting alongside their men when it comes to ethnic oppression. And yet the person who's your ally, who's your comrade when it comes to fighting ethnic oppression, turns around and becomes your oppressor. And now it's your turn to tell them, you know, I realize how much you're suffering because of all this ethnic oppressions, but you know you cannot come back and now oppress me. And then you cannot be a hypocrite. If you want justice and freedom, then you want to bring justice and freedom to your own house first. So it talks to the very tricky position of Kurdish women in this world, you know, how much we have to fight for national liberation, but at the same time, so fight with our men, but also fight against our men at the same time.
On the other side of the feminist spectrum, let's say, is Schiller, Joanna's daughter, who was born in prison and rebels all through childhood. She eventually goes off to the Kandil Mountains to join the Kurdish militants, the Peshmerga. And Layla, too, in the end, kind of finds herself and begins a career in the arts. To look at it more broadly, today the world knows something of how Kurdish women play key roles in Kurdish militant groups, and that the autonomous Kurdish enclave of Rojava in northeast Syria is in part defined by its gender equality and the prominence of women. In Turkey as well, the main Kurdish party fills most leadership positions with both a male and a female, such as former co-leaders of the party, Selahattin Demirtas and Figen Yüksekdag, both of whom are sadly in prison today. But, you know, we spoke of Layla's mother and kind of her, in a way, siding with the patriarchy. I wonder if you see the stories of Schiller and Leyla as suggesting Kurdish women are making progress, that we're starting to see Kurdish women emerge from this deeply patriarchal culture.
Oh, absolutely. And in that sense, Kurds in Syria and Turkey are such an inspiration to the Kurds in Iran and Iraq. So Schiller is this extremely interesting character whose name after the flower that's rare, that grows in really tough condition but comes in really vibrant colors. Schiller is named after the flower that's the most non-political representative of Kurdistan. Schiller is named after the flower that does not recognize border, that grows across Kurdistan plateau, regardless of what human decided to name this side of the land versus that side of the land. I really wanted the story to be Schiller's story, but I know that in literature, characters who are larger than life, they can't get to tell their own story. Someone else, a more average character, gets to tell the story of, say, like Gatsby or Schiller. And so even though Schiller is really brave, where Leyla is fighting a lot of fears and doubts and all of that, Schiller is someone who knows what she wants, who does not take too much oppression, then at what point she decides where she wants to find her liberation. And that's when she ends up with, the fighters. But what's amazing about Kurdish women, mainly in Syria, is not only they just fight and have their own militia, it's also that they were capable of, banning child marriage and polygamy and things like that. And again, look, going back to that double fight that Kurdish women are having, on one hand, yes, you're fighting side to side with your men to protect Kurdistan. On the other hand, you're fighting something within yourself, the voice that told you from the moment you're born that you're a woman, there's a ceiling to how much you can achieve in life. And then also teaching and educating other women that if you want to protect your children and if you want the best for your children, you wouldn't achieve it through reproducing patriarchy, instead by protecting them. And the title also comes from that. You are daughters of smoke and fire when you don't have real parents, where people who are supposed to shelter you and protect you become, in a way, agents of the state, by bringing in that oppression inside the home. And then here are these fabulous Kurdish women who have been able to overcome all of these obstacles that pile up,
Speaking of these fabulous, did you have any further?
No, go ahead.
Speaking of these fabulous Kurdish women, the novel has five parts, each of which are named after a character. Three are named for Leyla, one is named for Chia, Leyla's activist brother, and one for Alan, Leyla's father. I wonder, the book is called, Daughters of Smoke and Fire. I wonder why you chose not to give sections of the book to the three main non-protagonist female characters, Joanna, Schiller, and Leyla's mother. Was there any particular reason for that?
In fact, Schiller did have a section. It ended up not making its way to the final version of the
novel. I'm kind of sad about that. I really like her.
Me too, but we're translating the book to Kurdish, and she's going to have her own chapter over there. But what I was trying to examine, because when I first wrote the book, Alan had an entire manuscript. I was looking at intergenerational trauma and how Leyla and Chia inherited trauma that they didn't witness firsthand. Their parents did. Their grandparents did. So that was something I wanted to explore. And Alan's story had to be there because of, again, because of how he was, he then tried to do his own activism, and he fought for justice, and he was the one who was tortured. And just because of how all the options that he had, but also here's a dilemma of a novelist. On one hand, you have this world that you're imagining and you wish that things were like that. On the other hand, if you decide to create a realistic novel, then there is so much that you cannot do. For example, you cannot idealize life under oppression. You cannot idealize the situation of women. You want to do justice to what's actually in there, the reality of the situation, while offering glimpses of hope and strength and resilience. So these were really tough decisions that I had to make all the time, Do I am I creating something I as I wish they were, or am I trying to stay honest about what I saw, what I experienced firsthand, what I know the society is moving ahead? Because while Kurdish women in Syria, and I mentioned this in my talk at the UN too, while they're the one who are so empowered and liberated, Kurdish women are in Iran are committing suicide. Yesterday, a 16-year-old committed suicide because her father was trying to marry her off. And when I digged deeper and contacted people that I know in her city, they told me that her father had imprisoned her for months because he was a drug addict. He wanted her to marry this older but richer man. And so this is the reality that is going on. And as a novelist, yes, you know that YPJ is there and it's true and it's real. But also coming from Rosh Halat and knowing so little is said about Rosh Halat, how much can I bring the realities of Rojava into the realities of Rosh Halat?
Talking about your writing process, Farzad Kamangar was a Kurdish school teacher in an Iranian village who was imprisoned for being a member of the resistance, despite no evidence to this effect. In a series of letters, he detailed his suffering and his thoughts until he was executed in May 2010, just over 10 years ago. You write in the epilogue to the novel that you sobbed for hours upon hearing word of his death in Toronto at the time, and still looking to establish yourself as a successful writer. But Farzad's life and death taught you that giving up was the worst idea and inspired you to write this novel. I saw in a recent interview, you said, "I imagined if Farzad had a sister, what would she see? How could she find the strength to carry the torch passed on to her when so many women around her do themselves in?" So, I mean, you just mentioned the story of this woman who just did herself in yesterday. So how did Layla find the strength? And what to you, what does her story tell us about Farzad and his struggle?
So, David, in terms of why Farzad was able to shake something within me is, I've obviously read the stories of all these larger than life people all over the world, right? But it was something else when the person who was able to keep his humanity intact despite everything else was a Kurd, almost my age, from Rosh Halat. I think the closer people are to you as a person, the more inspiring they are in the sense that you're more allowed to say, if they could do it, perhaps I could do it too. So, yes, I had read, work by a lot of, I really like to read a lot of Black literature and Jewish literature and indigenous, just to see how they were able to deal with their situation and their extreme oppression and suffering that they went through. And there were people who would inspire me, but no one shook me the way Farzad did, because here's this guy being tortured because he has Kurdish ringtone on his cell phone, and yet he comes out and he talks about, the beauty of the mountains and the sounds of Kurdish music. And to me, that was unreal. To me, that was something that would only happen in books, not in real life. And here he was saying, "Oh, well, yeah, it is possible." Then when it comes to the question of, well, okay, Farzad was a really fantastic person, or at least he was the person I was looking for at that stage in my life to make myself believe that what I'm hoping to achieve is possible. And then when it comes to the question of women, David, it's really difficult. Like, so we're holding this workshops, suicide prevention workshops, and we educate young girls that here are, things, this is why people would consider suicide. This is how you can help them. These are the things you should not say, and these are the things you should say. And then at the end, we give them, questionnaires. We ask them to think of an adult that they would go to if something like this happens. And I've so far had three girls who have written for me, "What's wrong with you? You want to take away even death from them?" And no, if someone wants to kill themselves, I won't do any of this that you taught me. And that is so horrific, and yet so honest, and yet so raw, so naked, because what am I doing? Am I taking away the last option from them, really? So then if you want to to tell a person, a woman in the Kurdish region, that, you know what, life is worth living. You might want to continue fighting for a little bit longer. You might, if you don't have any ways to fight, maybe you want to hold on for a little bit longer. But is it really the message that you want to give them? And then, so then three questions that I constantly grapple with. One, should you go on? Two, if you decide that you do want to go on, how? And then, like, why and how? Should you? Why and how? Usually people, like when you read Holocaust literature, people can go on if they have someone or something that they want to stay alive for. And so in that sense, what enabled Leila to come back was Chia, her brother. You know, even in the world of men, in the world of judgmental, hypocritical men, she had Chia, who wasn't perfect, but was capable of understanding and had some feminist consciousness.
Mm. In a recent interview, you said that your departure from Iran was a lot like Leila's, in that until your passport was stamped, you didn't know whether you were going to make it out of the country. You had been a journalist, so I'm guessing you had some concerns that the government might have an issue with you leaving, not to mention traveling without your father's official permission. But I wonder how you felt in that moment. Surely there was the fear of being stopped and possibly imprisoned, the great hope of getting out and having a chance to build your own life. But I would guess that there was also some sadness, the thought of leaving your homeland, your people, and maybe never being able to return.
Exactly, David. Like every time I look back at it, I wonder if I'd be able to do it again. You know, it was just such a strange moment when it was a very, very difficult time in my life when I felt like there was no way ahead and there was no way back, that here I was at this dead end, constantly being harassed by the government, having no one and nothing to, like I said, to make meaning, to find a reason to go on. And I applied to a few universities, got admission, but I couldn't talk about it to anyone, and not just colleagues. I was teaching at a university at the time, writing part-time for newspapers, not just colleagues who would go and tell on me, but even like my own family. I didn't get to say goodbye to anyone, David. Mm-hmm. None of, and we have, you know, we have a collective culture. So you're very close to your cousins, to your aunts and uncles. No one knew that I had applied. No one knew except my one of my brothers. No one knew that I was in the process of going, and I couldn't say anything to anyone, because what if they had me, you know, go back and somehow something happened. And then when that moment, when my boarding pass was stamped, I remember going through, you know, the section, the glass section where only passengers can get in and mm-hmm. visitors can't go in. And I looked around me and I sat down in one of the seats there and I started crying. And it was a very strange sense, that there was a sense of relief that it's over, I made it. But at the same time, oh my God, this is it. I didn't even get to say goodbye. Mm. You know, and so all these years,
a joyful and sad crying at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. So all these years that I've been able to slowly, you know, make a home for myself here and slightly feel that maybe I can belong, if not to everyone, but at least to a small group of friends that I can make here. There have been also hours of really sadness when someone in the family passes away, or when my brother got married and I couldn't be there at his wedding. And so it's just all this combination of really conflicting emotions. You want to be grateful, you want to count your blessing, but at the same time, you can't deny that you left part of you when you left. Mm. David, I can't comment on that in public. You know how dangerous that is.
Ah, okay. You have no comment.
Sorry.
Okay. No, that's fine. Okay. There are so many parallels to Turkey in the book, unsurprisingly, since it has a significant Kurdish population. Young Kurdish students in Iran are beaten for being unable to speak the national language. Police attack and detain peaceful protesters. Much like Selahattin Demirtas, Chia is kept in prison despite the state bringing no real evidence against him. Kurdish heritage and traditions are essentially lost, erased, except for the stories passed down from generation to generation. Layla's father at one point describes Kurds in Turkey as hopeless. At another point, the novel mentions the Kurds in Bakur, the north, whose villages were burned and whose women were raped by the Turkish army. Reading all this, I was wondering how you and how Iranian Kurds see the Kurds in Turkey, particularly as you were growing up, which was mostly during years of intense violence between the Turkish state and the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK.
With a great sense of admiration, we look up to them. We are amazed by how much they have been able to accomplish, not only by standing up to state oppression, but also by changing the society in terms of, the idea of a society is not free until women are free, like you mentioned, to have co-leaders by men and women, and how they stand for justice, especially someone like Selahattin Demirtas, not just for for Kurdish rights, but really for human rights, for anyone whose rights is taken away because of their gender, sexuality, nationality, anything. Their ability to stay, to move beyond nationalism, their ability to organize themselves. Even in diaspora, there is a sense of deep admiration and respect for, of course, from Bakur, who even in diaspora, they're way more organized. They have much tighter communities. There is also the sense that, to some extent, they're more religious, more than Kurds in Iran. It's because, Iran was a country that religion and state were mixed, so there was a lot of like despise, I can say, for religion resulted from that, because all the oppression that was done in the name of God and in the name of Islam. They still, when they execute you, they call you an enemy of God. When Khomeini wanted to order the massacre of Kurds, they called us Mufsid fil Ars, as another quote from Quran, calling us corruptors on earth, calling us infidel, even though, on paper at least, majority of the Kurds over there are Sunni Muslims. But we don't see that in Bakur, of course. They still tend to rely more on their religion. Not always, but I'm generalizing here. Other than that, I was just saying that there is a sense of real aspiring to them. Not just today, like even in history, they have had, they've always been, more advanced in women's rights, and they have been braver in standing up for their own rights.
You wrote in that LitHub article I mentioned earlier, you wrote about Turkey's invasion of northeast Syria to push back the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, and you go into detail about the killing of Kurdish politician Mevrin Khalaf, which was caught on video. Khalaf was 35, about the same age, I believe, as Layla, and you, I think, as well. You wrote in that piece that Khalaf's killing swallowed you alive and paralyzed you for days. Forgive me for digging into your pain, but please, if you would explain why all of that was so difficult to see this proud achievement of Rojava return to the all too familiar violence and suffering Kurds have faced for so long.
So one of the things you learn as a Kurd is even when you have a little bit of joyful time, happy time, some freedom, it is going to be crashed, sure, and it's short-lived. And Rojava was really the beacon of hope for all of us. This was this place when we thought so much is possible. Everything that we dreamed for and fought for was finally possible in so many ways, in terms of, gender egalitarian, the bottom down, bottom up power structure. In so many ways, Rojava was this heaven, this paradise for us, this thing that was possible, that was happening, that was on earth. Wasn't perfect, wasn't beyond criticism, was really the best that had happened to the Kurds. And then, even though borders have been playing a significant role, and I don't deny them, but the Kurdish sense of solidarity is really beyond the borders. So every time there is an achievement, so the happiness and achievement of Rojava was for all of us, the same way Dersim massacre or Halabja massacre was everyone's pain, regardless of the borders. And when that was crushed, and so willy-nilly, so just out of one tweet and happening before the wide eyes of the world, and it's just I was crippled. I was literally crippled. I couldn't function for 3 days. I just was unable to do anything. And the other thing, the question about pain and personal pain is this is something I've struggled with as a journalist. Every time I interviewed a prisoner's family, heard the pain in their voices, the hope they had that the exposure might save their loved ones. And then Iran went ahead and executed the prisoner, the dissident, really for just their belief, and called them, like you said, called them a terrorist too. I would go through these stages of being unable to function and then trying to put myself back together and saying the only way I can do something is if I can, regain the lost power. It's really ongoing. Should I get up? How? Why? Should I get up? How? Why?
In that LitHub article, you also wrote that thanks to this brutally painful and difficult history, Kurds have become masters of rising from the ashes, of actually getting up, as you say. Without going into detail, this sums up to some extent the story of Layla. I wonder if the book's ending is a sign of how you see the Kurdish story today. You just described Rojava as a sort of paradise. Despite the Turkish incursion that was launched late last year, it still exists today. And one might say the Kurdish cause is today getting more international attention than it ever has. Would you say that the Kurds today have reached a place of hope and promise more than in, say, decades?
Whether or not the promise has been external, the internal hope and resistance has been alive. It's just amazing, honestly, David, that we're still alive despite all sorts of, ethnocide, cultural genocide, genocide, and all of that. So, yes, I believe in what I said. When the strongest motto or slogan is Berhodan, resistance is life. It really is. We kind of define ourselves in our ability to stand up, to create, more leaders, and especially women have been able to achieve so much. Kurdish women, we have poets, we have parliamentarians, we have painters, we have, there are more, as more and more Kurdish women are able to apply the idea that resistance is life into their own lives. And despite the injuries, they stand up and still keep going. They inspire more of us. We know that if it's possible, that if they could do it, then I can do it too. And absolutely, like, what is life without hope? What is fighting without resistance? We can't just give in, can we? So.
Okay, one last question I just wanted to ask. I saw something you said in a recent interview. You said, oppressors are so unoriginal, they all use the same methods. That's why we can win, because they're so dumb and afraid and predictable. The problem, you added, was that the oppressed had a tendency to turn against each other. This made me think of Layla's mother and her father, actually, as well, who disavowed her. But it almost sounded like you blame the Kurds just as much for their continued oppression as you blame their oppressors.
That's actually not true. I was only looking at human condition and how we internalize oppression. There was, I'm sure you've read about this study that was done with a Monopoly game, I think in Princeton University, but I'm not sure which university it was, where they gave the upper hand to a group for no reason, just gave them the chance to have more privileges starting from day one. And they looked at human behavior and saw how the underdog very soon started to behave like an underdog, even though what
It's like
they
the
lost.
Stanford experiment, yes.
Yeah, Stanford experience was another one with the prison guards, right? So I was saying, even though as humans we are, because I always look at us as our on default, we have our default, and then we have our the things that we're wired for, we're conditioned for over centuries, right? The tendency to destroy whoever looks different or sounds different from us, to be afraid of difference. And at the same time, we're wired for cooperation and peace and collaboration and all of those things. And how, as humans, this is our role to decide where we are and where we stand in life. What I was trying to say in that interview was, even though when you look at like Machiavelli's instruction, they're exactly the same things that the Iranian government or Turkish government are applying today. Mm-hmm. And in the sense, they're not original. We are capable of rising above all of these things if we believe that we don't deserve the way we are treated. You know, when you're a Kurdish child and you grow up and you're not allowed to speak your language and you see that your parents' language is not the language of prosperity and education and all of that, you start internalizing a lot of status quo, a lot of things that are normalized, right? And that doesn't, that by no means I'm trying to blame the Kurds. I don't say that we are beyond criticism. Of course, there is criticism, but I was saying that despite our general tendency to internalize what's normalized, the oppression that's normalized, we're also capable of uniting and seeing beyond that. And you see its examples really mostly prominently in Syria.
Okay, Ava Homa, author of Daughters of Smoke and Fire. It's really a fantastic book. Congratulations and best of luck with it. Thank you so much for your time and insight. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, David, for having me and for your really difficult questions.
You are welcome.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.